Hello, I'm Kate Jabot. Welcome to SITREP, your weekly look at the big issues in defence and world affairs. This time we're on board one of the Royal Navy's smallest vessels on exercise in Norway, building its capability to protect the UK's waters and shores.
So our commanding officer for the squadron wants us to become more operational based. We can get into a lot smaller places, deeper into the fjords than the frigates and 45s can get in there.
Also on SITREP, turning science fiction concepts into reality, the RAF officer in charge of its next generation of combat air power tells us how Tempest is taking shape.
A long-range, highly survivable next-generation platform with really quite impressive networking capabilities into other systems. But I've seen the designs, as you might expect, and I'm hugely excited by them. It really is a brilliant thing.
And learning the lessons of Ukraine and Gaza, as NATO builds up its military might, how will it be ready not just to fight, but protect civilians?
It is essential. We cannot think that we will protect 1 billion of the population without thinking that this is our objective, so the safety of the population.
SITREP
with Kate Jabot and Professor Michael Clark.
Mike, we often talk about the Royal Navy's carriers, destroyers and frigates operating on oceans across the globe. It's not so often that we mention the smaller vessels operating much closer to home, actually doing arguably the most important job, trying to keep our own shores safe.
Yes, and there's a lot more attention on that these days as we think about the threats to the homeland, which have increased because of the increased danger of hybrid warfare in relation to Russia and also partly to China. And so we have this class of Archer-class patrol vessels. I think there's about 14 of them. And they've got quite a big job to do because, I've been looking in some other work I've been doing at our vulnerabilities on pipelines. We have 5 big electrical pipelines coming in from the continent and about 4 more in development and a couple of pipelines that go from here to Ireland. We've got about 3 big gas pipelines with another couple being built. And of the 400 or so internet cables around the world, critical cables, about 20 of them come into the far west coast of Britain, basically into Cornwall. And they carry 40% of all internet traffic, those 20-odd cables. So there's an awful lot around our coastlines that we have got to defend. And we don't have a lot of facility to defend it. So these sort of small craft are all part of a multi-layered approach to taking our own territorial defence more seriously.
And they're some of the Royal Navy's smallest vessels and have been playing a giant game of hide and seek with Wildcat helicopters and stealthy Norwegian corvettes in the fjords of Norway. The P-2000 patrol boats are often seen mainly as training platforms, but they also have a role protecting UK waters. And this exercise is part of a drive to improve their operational capabilities. SITREP's David Sivels-McCann was in Norway for exercise Tambar Shield. Dave, good to speak to you. How did it work? What were they doing exactly?
Well, this is the Royal Navy focusing on how to defend and against fast attack craft at sea and develop search and destroy tactics. So 4 Wildcat helicopters from 815 Naval Air Squadron and 4 P-2000 ships are exercising around the very rugged west coast of Norway. Also, as you mentioned, the Skull-class corvette ships of the Norwegian Navy, some of the elite ships in their fleet. In fact, despite our best efforts, we were unable to get on board them as the Norwegian military are very protective of them. In fact, they've got the same security around the vessels and the crew as the Royal Navy has around our own nuclear submarines. But as you said, it's essentially a giant game of hide and seek in the deep, narrow inlets of the fjords that offer some very good hiding spaces. The P-2000s and corvettes took it in turns to work with the Wildcats to hunt one another during the exercise, to develop their abilities to work together in this area of coastal security, as Commanding Officer of HMS Bighter, Lieutenant Sophie Tulloch, explains.
So we're currently hiding in a fjord at the moment, working with HMS Exploit and one other Wildcat from 815 Naval Air Squadron in order to locate and destroy 2 of the Skull-class corvettes. And we're making our way slowly up the fjord in order to identify them, send off their location to the Wildcat so that they can be engaged. They're very sneaky, they're camouflaged, they know the areas like the back of their hands, they do all their training around here. So for us, It's very much a real life scenario in terms of operating in a new area, out of our comfort zone, far away from home.
And Dave, you were on board HMS Bighter. What was it like?
Well, as you say, the P2000s are among the smallest ships in the fleet, but they're actually deceptively spacious once you get into them. Anyone who's probably seen one from the outside would imagine it's very cramped, but there's enough room for the crew to comfortably operate a very small galley below deck, even with one of those little air fryers to cook on deck as well. Usually, the usual compact sleeping conditions that you get on any ship in the Royal Navy. Most of our time was actually spent on the top deck where the ship is operated from, and it can get very windy on these vessels. They can reach speeds of up to sort of 25 knots, and you certainly feel the wind chill in the fjords when she gets up to speed. Thankfully for us, it was quite smooth sailing being in the fjords, because I imagine these small vessels can move around a bit in the rough seas.
I bet. And this is about more than just practicing, though, with an ally. It's also about enhancing the capability of the P2000s.
Yeah, the P2000s have largely been used recently to develop basic seamanship skills around the UK coast, and even for some naval engagement with some of the coastal communities during the summer. But the ships and the crews are getting more experience in directly supporting the development of the Royal Navy's frontline capability. Recently, they deployed to Steadfast Defender, the largest NATO exercise since the Cold War. On Tambour Shield, the sailors are getting more of that experience in working with other units like 815 Naval Air Squadron and allies in the Norwegian Navy. And Able Rate Bailey Jackson, one of the crew on HMS Bighter, says it shows what these small, nimble ships can offer.
So our commanding officer for the squadron wants us to become less of sort of training university built and more operational based. We can get into a lot smaller places, deeper into the fjords than the frigates and 45s can get in there. So we can actually go out, deploy units to the ground. We've got a couple of extra sort of personnel on board. So gives them a bit of training into what the Navy is like and how we can impact the operation going forward.
Now, the ships are part of the Coastal Forces Squadron, and this is the ships getting back to the tradition of that squadron and helping provide security around the coastal waters of the UK and northwestern Europe. And as Mike said, this is an area of particular interest with a lot of Russian activity in the region. And while the P2000s have been focusing on that sort of university training mission in recent years, this is them really stepping up to play a larger role in supporting the maritime security mission around the North Sea.
Mike, just give us some context here on the P2000s. If they are to step up, how can their role be enhanced exactly?
Yes, I mean, they're given more operational work to do. And as Dave was showing there, they've got to integrate with other aspects of the force, because coastal defence and security, territorial security, is a multi-layered problem. And it isn't just the sort of Russian-inspired threat to pipelines and so on, but it's also criminality, narcotics, gang warfare. There are all sorts of reasons why we need to take our territorial security a bit more seriously. And that's a job for the Navy and the Air Force and some elements of the Army and the intelligence services. But at the moment, you know, the Navy is working very hard. More or less every naval asset is being worked a lot because the Navy is very busy. So I think it's absolutely right that the Coastal Forces Squadron, these Archer P2000 boats, will do more. They're very good. They're very good. And they, you know, they're very flexible. My only problem with the P2000s is the names. I mean, Dave was on the Bighter, but you look, yeah, you look at the others. There's the Blazer, the Puncher, yeah, the Dasher, the Charger. I mean, they sound like Santa's reindeers.
Who makes those names up, honestly, Mike? Where do they come from?
I don't know. Somebody with a sense of humour. Because if you add one of the bigger offshore patrol vessels to them called Rudolph, you'd have the full set.
Because the thing is, when I was reading the script, I said Bighter. Bite as in bite? Yes, bite as in Bighter. Okay, yes. Anyway, moving on. Mike, just thinking geographically, at the fjords, they're a pretty good match for the P2000's role patrolling close to Faslane, aren't they, where the nuclear subs are based?
They are, and one of the jobs that they do is actually look after the channels as the bombers come in and out, which is a very sensitive moment, of course, the bombers, the nuclear submarines, as they come in and out of the Firth of Clyde in Faslane. Those channels have to be protected, and they're protected in all sorts of ways that are, you know, fairly classified. But the Archer-class boats have a role to play each time one of the bombers comes in and out, and that's pretty important.
Dave, what about the Fleet Air Arms Wildcats helicopters? What's in this exercise for them?
Well, again, the Norwegian fjords offer a great location for these aircraft to enhance their ability to provide that coastal security. The role is carrying out warship protection, surveillance and intelligence gathering. Finding these small fast ships like the P-2000s and the Corvettes are a big challenge in the fjords. I mean, I was actually lucky enough to get on board one of the Wildcats for a flight during the exercise. And from the air, you really get a sense of just how challenging this coastal terrain is and how finding these small, fast vessels is by both air and sea. Commanding officer of 815 Naval Air Squadron, James Wood, says this exercise is a really great test of their abilities.
So we're essentially practicing fighting against anything from small, fast attack craft all the way through up to frigates and destroyers. Recently introduced into service is the Martlet weapon system, a laser beam-riding missile, particularly useful against fast attack craft, so we're really utilising this opportunity to practice our tactics to employ that weapon system. The geography around here is really useful for a training ground, so there's lots of rocky outcrops. The fjords allow a lot of places for fast attack craft to hide. They're pretty well camouflaged in that terrain, so finding them is a real challenge, and also avoiding being attacked by them is also a challenge, so it provides a really useful training ground for us to work within.
But these Wildcats are just absolutely fantastic to be in. The aim of the sortie I was on was actually to evade detection from a Norwegian frigate, the Roald Amundsen, using that terrain of the fjords to get as close to her as possible when she was out at sea. One thing that struck me was the two-person crew flying the aircraft were just in constant dialogue with each other, the pilot, the observer, constantly exchanging that information about the terrain and the mission. It was a very manoeuvrable helicopter, but luckily for me, a very smooth ride on a beautiful Norwegian evening. Despite not being a very tall man myself, I could have done with a little more headroom in the back, but you can't really complain when you get to enjoy the Norwegian fjords.
Exactly, Dave. You really can't have everything, can you now? You've had a very good time on this. It's good to hear your thoughts on this exercise. Thank you. Mike, before we move on, can we just talk about the really sharp end of the Royal Navy's job right now? For months, it's been working to protect shipping from Houthi drone and missile attacks in the Red Sea. Now it looks like those attacks can reach much further, with a drone strike reported in the Indian Ocean.
Yes. I mean, Houthis are getting help from Iran in doing this, and they've extended from the Red Sea, the southern end of the Red Sea, into the Gulf of Aden, and now further into the Indian Ocean itself. That's a problem. On the other hand, the attacks have not been as numerous as they were. To some extent, the Houthis seem to be being contained by the action that's been taken against them. But it's in Iran's interest to keep the Houthi threat alive to shipping as a bargaining chip. But it is a problem for global shipping, which everyone is having to react to. We shouldn't overemphasize it. The Houthis are creating a problem of disruption, but they've not developed in the way that people thought they might develop in January or February this year. So far, there's been more containment, has been more successful against them than I think people expected.
This put in the alternative route to the Red Sea, the long way round via the Cape of Good Hope at risk. Is the Allied naval capacity available to add protection here too, if necessary?
Well, it should be. I mean, everyone, as it were, points the finger at Britain and America as the two active countries because they're attacking the Houthis. But there are 12 nations involved in the whole operation to try to protect the Red Sea and these routes. And the biggest contributor in terms of numbers of ships is the Indian Navy. And of course, attacks into the Indian Ocean bother the Indians a lot, and they bother the Chinese. So I don't think there's any lack of naval capacity to help to protect ships or to help to go to their aid when they need it. The issue is really how much disruption it causes to the merchant marine. They have to adjust their routes, and they can do that. That adds a bit of cost and a bit of time to what they do. And certainly going around the Cape of Good Hope is not good news if you were planning to go up the Red Sea and through the Suez Canal. But the world is adjusting to that. And I guess this situation may last for another year or two. But there's no shortage of naval assets in the region. The question is mobilizing them to some more collective purpose. At the moment, only Britain and America are taking a strong lead on this. I suspect that other navies might step up as these attacks become more widespread.
From the sea to the skies now, and we've been talking about Tempest as the high-tech future of the RAF's combat air power for almost a decade. The concepts have sounded almost like science fiction: laser weapons, brain sensors and cockpit controls within a helmet. But time is ticking to turn concepts into reality. In 3 years' time, we should see the first prototype of Tempest. And in just over 10 years, the UK and two allies want the first Tempest planes in service. So, how is it shaping up? I've been talking to Air Commodore Martin Lowe, Programme Director of the Future Combat Air System, which has Tempest at its core.
The plane, UK, Italian, Japanese, developed and built sovereign capability, complementing the F-35 aircraft that all three nations have also procured. It will be a next generation, long range, highly survivable, highly networked capability, undertaking quite a range of military missions as part of a wider system that will also involve or include uncrewed systems. We all see from the news the increasing use of uncrewed systems and artificial intelligence driven platforms in the modern battlefield. That trend will continue. So we will be developing those systems alongside pilots in fighter planes of the future.
So we've talked before on SITREP about some of the ambitious concepts, and you've alluded to some there, these laser-directed energy weapons, a software-reconfigurable cockpit within the pilot's helmet, sensors detecting the pilot's stress levels, almost reading their mind, as it were. What else has made the cut, and what's fallen by the wayside? And what still has to be decided?
So the process of designing any complex military capability, including a combat aircraft, it's a big endeavour. It takes a long time. The three nations have got remarkably close alignment on the requirements of this capability. I'm a little bit limited by my classifications into how much detail I can go into, I'm afraid. But we can talk about a long-range, highly survivable next-generation platform with really quite impressive networking capabilities into other systems. And you're right to point out capabilities like software-driven activity and the ability to rapidly upgrade the capability through software, through artificial intelligence, through the increasing use of data, so that we can respond to threats of the future and have a platform that can evolve over time.
And the first deadline is for a demonstrator aircraft to be ready in 2027. That is in 3 years' time. Physically, do you know exactly what that will look like now?
The demonstrator is a UK-only project. It is intended to fly around the 2027 time period, and progress on that aircraft is well underway. The design is pretty well fixed now. It's proving a hugely valuable endeavour for the UK, and the benefits, the learning we are taking from developing and building that demonstrator are being learned in the Global Combat Air Programme. The engineers who've been working on it are moving over to the trinationally with Italy and Japan to build the real thing in the long term. The experiences we're getting from design, the development, the build, they're all being taken over into the main program. So a really, really brilliant UK demonstrator initiative that we hope to see airborne soon.
You say the design is fixed. Can you tell us what it looks like?
I'm afraid not, and perhaps we'll have to leave that to a big reveal at the appropriate moment. There are some sensitivities around the size and shape and the design of aircraft of this nature. So at this point, no. But I've seen the designs, as you might expect, and I'm hugely excited by them. It really is a brilliant thing.
That was going to be my consolation backup question, was whether or not you're impressed by it, but obviously you are. 7 years on from that, Tempest is supposed to go into service in 2035. How much of that is finishing the development and how much is build time?
Well, it's a bit of both. And of course, the two things are not necessarily sequential. There is a lot of parallel activity. In fact, in the long term, we plan to continually evolve the Global Combat Air Programme aircraft. We mentioned earlier about data and artificial intelligence and software, and those will be ways, avenues by which we will keep upgrading the aircraft. So the design process never stops. It's part of the reason why we keep investing in research and development in combat air through the Team Tempest initiative. So we keep having new technologies to add to it.
And Tempest is just one part of what's called, as you said earlier, the Future Combat Air System. Can you just walk us through the other parts of that system?
The most obvious place to talk about is uncrewed systems. We don't think we're quite ready to have a fully uncrewed system yet. So we envisage the future system to be a mix of crewed piloted planes in the traditional sense and uncrewed systems alongside it. We will find the right balance of those things to have the necessary military effect. It's fair to say in the future, combat air systems will be fully uncrewed. Quite how far in the future is a debate we could probably spend hours talking about if we wanted. And the development of those of all these concepts is happening right now, both in the UK and with our partners in Italy and Japan, so that we will develop the right mix of capabilities together.
Air Commodore Martin Lowe, the RAF's Programme Director for the Future Combat Air System. Mike, given the F-35 is still relatively new, how much of a leap will Tempest and the Future Combat Air System be when they're in service?
Yes, well, the F-35 is fifth generation and this Future Combat Air System is sixth generation, and that's the architecture of that is still being worked out. But you know, with Air Commodore Lowe said that he couldn't tell you what the aircraft will look like. I have seen it. Yeah, I can. Yeah, it's at Marham, RF yes. Marham, and it's there. And it is a fiberglass version of what a full-size fiberglass version of what some future aircraft might or might look like. And it's there for ministers to be photographed in front of and shake hands in front of and so on. So there it is. That is the new Tempest system is there, but it's just it's a big Airfix model. And it may the real one may or may not look like that, but they feel that they've got to have something that looks like an aeroplane for the sake of publicity. And what Air Commodore Lowe said is that the most important word he used, I think, in that interview is network ability, because this sixth generation fighter capability is all about networking. So whether one aircraft can direct another six uncrewed aircraft, robot aircraft, plus all the connectivity it needs to air control, electronic warfare, ground issues, satellite, and so on. It's all about networking. So the idea, and I've heard the chief of the defense staff talk about this, he said, we could conceive in the not too distant future of an air force of 1,000 aircraft, of which only 100 of them have pilots in them. We could think of a navy of 600 ships, of which only 50 are crewed ships. That's the sort of thinking that we are moving towards robotics, where a number of aircraft are used and operate like any other fighter, but only one or two pilots are involved in directing 10 or 15 aircraft.
So could Tempest be our final ever crewed fighter jet? Do you think the next generation after that could really be UAVs only?
Well, interestingly, the Air Commodore Lowe said that ultimately that's the route we're on, but he wasn't sure when it would happen. I wonder about that. I mean, I'm sure he's ultimately right. But, you know, one of the things that always strikes me is that when you look at warfare, there is always a cutting edge of technology because all technology gets used in warfare one way or another. But when wars take place, they're not usually only about the cutting edge technology. They also stretch back at least a century, sometimes two centuries, in terms of the technology. And so when you look at wars, when they actually take place, they usually involve a range of technologies over decades and decades of development. And you know, the first American aircraft carrier I went on in the 1980s was the Nimitz. And looking at the Nimitz then, that was state of the art, and it was astonishing. It looked like something out of the Star Wars or Star Trek. It looked like the Starship Enterprise in some respects. But in other respects, there were big Bakelite switches, things that looked as if they'd come from Dan Dare in the 1950s. You saw machinery with big levers on them that had to be pulled. And you realize that even on an aircraft carrier like that, you're dealing with a range of about 50 years of technology from what was around 50 years ago, which still works, to what is 21st century stuff, or this was 1985, but looking towards the 21st century, the best that technology could provide. And so I think when we think about cutting-edge technologies, we've also got to be aware of the long technological tail that warfare also involves.
There's much more from my conversation with Air Commodore Martin Lowe, including the race to stay ahead of our adversaries and the big question, will it come in on time and on budget? That's all in an extra edition of the SITREP podcast online now.
News, discussions and analysis. This is SITREP.
Now, military power has a number of different jobs. It is to deter conflict. It is also to defeat your adversary in the event deterrence is not enough. But ultimately, it's about protecting human life. Amid the warnings we're in a pre-war era, the NATO alliance is updating its strategy for delivering human security, just as it's updated its strategies for combat and deterrence. Human security was central to discussions among senior officers on the recent exercise Eagle Eye in Italy, ahead of the new Allied Reaction Force standing up in a few weeks. A keynote address came from the NATO Secretary General's Special Representative for Women, Peace and Security, Irena Felin, and she also spoke to SITREP's James Hurst.
We cannot think that we will protect 1 billion of the population without thinking that this is our objective, so the safety of the population. So it's not an add-on and not something that we can consider in the way to achieve our strategic objective. This is a kind of a lens that we have to put in front to achieve the strategic goal.
You talk about human security policy needing to update, to reflect how security landscape has changed. What needs to be updated? How does that need to change?
So human security approach at NATO is an umbrella of 5 policy. It starts on protection of civilians. It covers also children and armed conflict, conflict-related sexual violence, combating trafficking against human beings, and cultural property protection. So under this umbrella, there are 5 policy areas. And protection of civilian is, I can say, that the most important one, is the one that covers a little bit everything. This policy at NATO was developed in 2016 in a period where we were heavily present in Afghanistan, so our work was driven by a crisis management approach. Today, the security environment has changed, our own posture has changed, so we have to reflect this change of the armed forces, the change of our strategy with the new regional plans, and to see how the alliance would have to be prepared to respond on a possible intervention on our own territory.
What do you think the changed security environment, how do you think that is most going to impact the way human security is delivered?
It's very important to connect the work of human security with resilience. So those are the two areas that have to come together when we look in a different type of intervention, not outside of the area of responsibility, but on the alliance territory. This means that really look into how we will have to defend our population on our own territory and to think that the resilience dimension of the population is important. So it's not only defending people, but defending the status and being ready to respond and to resist to the enemy.
And you also have a very specific responsibility for women in human security. Just explain that role and how you deliver that within NATO.
Indeed. So those are two different areas, but they are very much interconnected. So the Women, Peace and Security agenda is based on Resolution 1325, a resolution that the United Nations adopted in the year 2000. Two main messages of this resolution is that conflict and wars affect men and women in a different way, with a disproportionate impact on women and girls, due to the different roles that we have within the society. But the other very important message is that women play an incredible role as part of the conflict and peace cycle. So what do you need to do is to create the right space for women to take part in conflict management and resolution. And at the same time, when we look at the need to protect women, and this is where the areas are interconnected with protection of civilians, we need to understand what the specific security needs of women are. We will never achieve our goal and protect the population thinking that the population is one unicum. We are different, so women and men and boys and girls and all individuals, they have security needs that are specific and distinct. So we as an alliance across all NATO enterprise, we need to integrate this consideration of the gender lens, of the different needs of the population to make sure to support them and protect them when it's needed.
What are the most significant different security needs for women and girls?
It's the way in which we leave the space. It's where we have to go is how we move in the city. When we talk about urban warfare, this is the kind of scenario that we are discussing even here in these days during Eagle Eye, is to understand where women could be more vulnerable. And the first thing that certainly comes into my mind is conflict-related sexual violence. Unfortunately, we could see in the past, but we see again and again that in each and every conflict and wars, women and girls are unfortunately the first target in terms of conflict-related sexual violence. They are survivors, and it's very important to that the military understand this as part of the human security environment to be able to prevent and protect women and girls from these attacks.
When you have politicians across Europe warning that we could be on the edge of war, that we are in a pre-war era, to quote Britain's Defence Secretary, how hard is it for you to get people faced with that overarching potential threat to build in issues of human security and then specific issues of human security for women and girls?
I will be honest, it's not always easy. It is more, it is easier for us to talk this at political level. We are an alliance of values. We as promoting gender equality and looking at the well-being of the population, having this human security approach is very high on the political agenda. But it's true that once we start entering in different phases of the work, the urgency is to do something else. So my role and my responsibility is to bring these two dimensions together, as I said at the beginning. And this is why I'm here. I found here today a very privileged environment where there is no need to advocate too much because there is the willingness to continue work on human security that the NRDC has already started in the past years. But it's certainly important to bring, to connect the dots and bring all the elements together, because it's so easy to forget about this dimension when we think about entering into the war.
One final thought, what lessons do you think we should take from the most recent conflicts that we are seeing in Ukraine, in the Middle East, about our approach to human security and security of women and girls as NATO nations?
I think it's part of the conflict analysis, so applying a gender and a human security lens. That's what we have learned at NATO when we started analyzing the war in Ukraine, that at the very beginning it was not automatic to bring this perspective in our analysis. So I started working very closely with my colleagues in the analysis, at the intelligence, and with all the other divisions to make sure that when we update our with our briefing and our analysis, we need to include this perspective since the beginning. And this is the difference, that what I hope we learn from this is that we have to integrate this and measure in the same way in which we do the rest. And the other message is that if we want to have women as part of the security, we need to enable them to be part in peace times, because during war, we will not be ready to address certain barriers and challenges. And this is what Ukraine is teaching us. If you look at the incredible and unprecedented number of women who joined the armed forces during the past 2 years, we could also see that the armed forces were not ready to absorb women with the right equipment, with the right uniform, and many other challenges that are present. So they are facing the challenges. NATO as an alliance is trying to support throughout the comprehensive assistance package. We're trying to contribute to the production of combat uniform and bulletproof vest tailor-made on the body of women. But we all have to learn from this. We need to be prepared before a possible war.
The NATO Secretary General's Special Representative for Women, Peace and Security, Irena Felin. Mike, just before we finish, we should talk about the NATO Secretary General job. Turkey has now endorsed the former Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte. Is he now a dead cert to be appointed, and what kind of credentials does he bring?
Yes, it would be very unlikely now if he wasn't appointed, because he's got the backing of the United States and Germany, France, Britain. The only countries that have come out explicitly against him were Romania, and Hungary, because they had very particular problems with the Netherlands, and I don't think that counts for very much at the moment. There were thoughts last year, of course, that the next SecGen ought to be a woman, or it ought to be somebody from Southern Europe, but it looks as if they've gone for something more traditional, a North European politician. And Mark Rutte is a very good one, because he's the longest serving Dutch prime minister. He's been prime minister in the Netherlands since 2010, now stepping down for interesting reasons. But having been a prime minister for so long in the Netherlands politics, it gives him a couple of qualities. One is that, you know, Netherlands politics is constant coalition building and coalition maintenance. So he is very experienced at holding together difficult coalitions. And that's an important qualification for any NATO Secretary General. He's also regarded as Teflon Mark, in that there are always scandals around in any political system. And he seems to emerge from them, not tarnished by them, with a reputation for integrity. Some would say he's an escape artist, but it doesn't matter. I mean, he does have a reputation for honesty and directness and integrity, and that sort of straightforwardness. And I think the third element I would put is that he's very strong on the Ukraine war. He's both very determined in favor of NATO's role to help Ukraine, but also very practical, very pragmatic. Netherlands was, gave its Patriot battery, for instance, to Ukraine when others are still reluctant to do so. So he's very strong on that. And if you think about, you know, Stoltenberg stepping down and Mark Rutte taking over, if that's what happens, and I think it will, then that represents both a sort of vigorous but also sort of a continuity response from NATO. There'll be more of the same. We'll continue with vigor. And this next Secretary General will carry on what Stoltenberg has done since the invasion of Ukraine. So it's essentially good news.
And when do we find out, Mike?
At the Washington summit. Okay. So quite soon. We'll know beforehand, but it will be established. I think it'll be ratified at the summit in Washington.
Okay, July then. Thanks, Mike. Yeah. And thanks to all of our guests. That's all for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. Until then, don't forget you can hear more about the development of the RAF's next generation of combat air power in an extra edition of the SITREP podcast online now. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
On the battlefield, death is always just around the corner. But some have come face to face with it.
Some come back home with parts of body missing.
And some come back home in a coffin.
And somehow lived to tell the tale.
The first thing I remember was this huge bang.
And they turned to me and said, like, now you're going to be taken to be shot.
It's hard to explain the moment that I got set on fire because
nothing makes sense.
These are their stories. This is Near Death.
A brand new podcast from BFBS. Listen via bfbs.com/near death or wherever you get your podcasts.